Okay, so we got that official announcement. Our committee co-chairs have asked me to open and lead today's call. Al Christopher in Virginia is going to be joining in a few minutes, and unfortunately, Jeff Pitkin in New York was unable to make today's discussion. So you'll be hearing a little bit more of my voice than usual, but I'll try to keep it brief. I wanted to go over a few housekeeping items. First, just a reminder to stay on mute unless you have a question or a comment that you'd like to make. Also, please note that we have a few PowerPoint presentations to help guide today's call. A link to a compiled set of slides was in the email that you received earlier today. It's also on the event webpage on our website. So if you go to nasio.org, click on the Financing Committee call link in the list to the right under events. It's the third event down. Then click the section where it says click here for presentations in all caps. That will lead you to today's presentations. If you're having any trouble, just shoot me an email and I'll send you the slides directly. And with that, I will get us started. So if you turn now to the agenda and the slide deck that that I've shared, first I'll be starting off with a few announcements that you might find to be of value. Then we'll be really focusing today on revolving loan funds. We'll be covering a few different angles on RLF, including data that NASIO has been collecting from you all across the state on your financing programs, as well as a few different models for administering RLFs from Texas, Alabama, Washington, and Nebraska, and also from other states that are on the line if you care to share about what you're doing. So you'll see on slide two that I've listed a few objectives at the bottom of the slide. There are a couple things that I'm hoping to get out of today's call. First, you know, some of you have asked for more information on revolving loan funds, specifically how they're run, implemented, administered, designed, and also how they're evolving. And I think the lineup of states that we have today can really help us get some insights on those questions. And then second, I'm really hoping this call can help us identify any issues or challenges that states are running into. So over the next hour or a couple of calls that we have as we look at this closer, please do weigh in with the issues that you're coming across. Chances are there is another state out there that has gone through something similar or is going through something similar. So there's some really good opportunities for peer exchange. And you know, one potential end product that we might want to think about if it might be of value to the committee is a brief guide that NASIO can help develop with your all input to help states either set up or improve their revolving loan funds. Also to the extent that some of the issues that you're encountering concern SEP funds. We have great friends at DOE, both on the line and also just at DOE in general, that can help us address those issues. I'll pause right there and see if anyone new has joined the call.
Maria Redmond from Wisconsin is here.
Mitchell Simpson in Arkansas.
Hey, Mitchell. Al Christopher, Virginia.
Yeah. Okay, great. So Maria, Mitchell, and Al, we are just on the slide deck now at slide number three. So with that opening, I just wanted to get moving on our agenda. But first, I wanted to highlight some updates and announcements for all of you. First is on the Financing Committee listserv and online forum that you should have received an email about a couple months ago. I received confirmation from the team that is helping us set up that website that they've set up accounts for everyone who had signed up. And I'm working on recruiting a handful more of states as well as interested affiliate members of NASIO. So I'm expecting that our online group will be up and running in the next couple of weeks. So likely in early May, I'll be hosting a brief tutorial webinar to show folks how to use that website, including the chat and email listserv functions. And if you haven't received the form to sign up, just let me know and I can pass it your way, or I can make sure that you get an account set up if you're not able to access that form. That second bullet point, several of you have worked with me in the past several months to provide input into a report that NASIO has just finalized on statewide commercial PACE programs. That is going to be released very shortly, so I just wanted to give you the heads up to look out for it in your inbox. We just are getting the final green light from DOE, which supported the work. So hopefully it provides some good information as you all work on PACE financing. We also have a few events that I wanted to bring to your attention. One is the ACEEE Finance Forum. That is May 22nd to 24th in Newport, Rhode Island. It's looking like a really great agenda. And we have Brian Stickles from ACEEE on the line. Brian, I'm not sure if you want to make a brief plug for the conference at all, but you're more than welcome to.
Oh, thanks, Andy. I appreciate that. I'd love to see you all there. And Sandy's actually going to be on two panels, so it's going to be well represented. Thanks, Sandy.
Thanks, Brian. And then, as many of you know, we also have our series of NASIO regional meetings underway, starting with the Southeast Regional Meeting in Little Rock, Arkansas, next week. We'll hopefully be seeing you all there, and the link www.nasio.org/events has the full schedule in case you're interested. In the next few weeks, I'll also be starting a new research project focused on, it's called a federal financing playbook for state energy offices. And the idea there is really to share information on the various federal programs that states can tap into for clean energy financing. So it's not just limited to Department of Energy financing programs, but also to EPA, HUD, IRS, Commerce, Transportation, and USDA. And to highlight some examples of how states have taken advantage of these programs. So I may be bugging you in the next couple of months for information about how you've worked with those various programs, if you have any examples that you'd like to share. I'll pause here. I want to see if anyone has any updates, questions, concerns before we move on. Okay. Hearing none, I will move right on. So slide 4 includes the results from our financing survey. Thanks to so many of you for responding to that survey form and providing data for this database. Some quick high-level data. We are tracking about $1.7 billion of funds in state energy office programs. And that's not even including the ways that states are leveraging private capital. It also doesn't include PACE or QECB issuances, except where those funds are being used to expand loan size. And so it's a pretty conservative estimate. We're really excited about that number, and I think it just really shows that states are excited and really helping impact the financing landscape in terms of clean energy. We know of 35 states that have revolving loan funds or credit enhancement programs. A much larger share, nearly every state, has interaction with financing in some way, whether through qualified energy conservation bonds, property assessed clean energy, green banks, or other initiatives. So also still a very thriving area for the state energy offices. According to data from PACE Nation, there are 32 states plus the District of Columbia with PACE enabling legislation, and another 15 have, or of those 15 have completed commercial projects, and 3 have completed residential projects. So some great activity there. We did a quick scan of comprehensive state energy plans. 24 of those include some major reference to financing. Showcasing it as an important tool to help states advance their energy priorities. According to data from EPC, we have about $1.2 billion in QECB issuances across the states, and that is equivalent to almost 40% of the $3.2 billion authority from ARRA. Again, I think we're seeing great progress. Was there a question? Maybe I misheard. Okay. The next slide just really includes a snapshot of some of the data that I just shared. You'll see a few states that have heavily invested in financing programs, so the darker the color on this map, the greater the size of the loan funds that we found. There are also spots marking which states have launched a green bank. That's from data provided by the Coalition for Green Capital, and where PACE projects have actually been funded. So that's those 15 states from PACE Nation. So again, mostly just kind of a high-level overview of some of the data that we got from you all from this financing survey. And then finally, slide 6, I won't go through in much detail, but I think it just really includes some interesting examples of programs themselves, and sometimes these stories can be obscured by the higher level data in these maps and databases. So we'll be hearing about a couple of these programs, particularly Nebraska and Texas, which have managed to really multiply the impact of their public funds by leveraging private capital as well as their own, as well as revolving their own fund. I've also included some information about New York's program. NYSERDA has been really aggressive about engaging the secondary market to support Green Jobs, Green New York, and those few bullet points just include some of the various ways that they've tapped into investment. And then I thought it was interesting from our financing program survey that a couple of states are helping bringing financing not just to homes and established businesses, but also to supporting technology innovation and commercialization. So we're seeing examples of financing being brought to startups in both Virginia and in Illinois, which is, I think, is a really exciting story to tell as well. I'll pause here and see if there are any questions. I would just like to thank you all again for providing the data that you did to the survey. I think it's helping make our database stronger and more up to date. So, and I know it was a pretty heavy lift. Okay, great. So if there are no other questions, we'll next be hearing from Deb Taylor and Eddie Trevino with the Texas State Energy Conservation Office. They have agreed to speak to us today about their Lone Star program, which is a revolving loan fund that's administered by the State Energy Office entirely. So Deb and Eddie, I'll pass the phone along to you to take it from here.
Okay, thanks, Andy. I guess slide 9 kind of gives an overview intro slide, and then there's some details in the next one. I'm going to provide a little history and an overview of our program, then let Eddie jump into some more of the details and the breakout of the active loans we've had. So Deb Taylor, CECO Director, State Energy Conservation Office in Texas. The revolving loan program we operate here is called Lone Star, L-O-A-N-S-T-A-R, which is a play on words. The nickname for the state of Texas is the Lone Star State, L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R, and so we wanted to have something a little catchy when the program started. So it's L-O-A-N, and then the S-T-A-R stands for Saving Taxes and Resources. So I would love to take credit for that, but I didn't come up with the name. Someone else did before I was here, but the program's been in existence for 20-plus years. It is a public sector-only project, loan program, so only public entities, taxpayer-supported entities are eligible to apply for funding and have projects funded through the program. We did have a pilot program that was authorized by our state legislature targeting certain types of nonprofits and houses of worship, and we ran that program for a couple of years and didn't have much traction with it. Now that program has dissolved, so it's back to public sector only. The nature of the way we operate the program, different funding sources capitalize our loan fund. We actually lend cash out of the treasury that we have available, so it's not a third party. It's not a leverage situation. We're actually lending directly. The value of the program itself is right now about $215 million, the fund. About 60% of that is state dollars, most of which originated through oil overcharge or PVE. About 4% of that is regular formula SEP dollars that we have funded projects and then have been able to evergreen those one-time SEP dollars into a portion of our revolving loan program. And then 36% of our fund is remaining ERA SEP funds. So again, we're able to evergreen some of the ERA funds that we received. The loans themselves, they're unsecured loans. They're premised on the project payback. So the terms are currently a 10-year max term on simple payback calculation. The interest rates, the last loan solicitation we conducted were 2% fixed over the term of the loan for regular non-ERA funds, and then we actually dropped the interest rate to 1% for ERA funds. Given the additional administrative challenges and reporting challenges and costs associated with ERA-funded projects, so that's the way we've handled those two pots of money. We segregate them, and we fund projects entirely with one flavor of money or the other. The scope of the projects, as well as the repayment, those are outlined in enforceable contracts. These are either interagency or interlocal contracts that we have with cities, counties, school districts, state agencies, public higher institution, educations. And then all of the loan origination and all the servicing we do in-house. On that point, I'll mention that we have a very low cost of operating the program. If you look at the repayment interest revenue in a given year, and I'll look at FY 2015 for example, we had about $2.3 million in repayment interest revenue. That's in addition to the principal repayment. And our expenses for operating the program that year, which includes all engineering reviews, field site work, et cetera, was less than $400,000, so about 16% of the revenue. The balance of that then went back into the program to help grow the fund, and then we're able to use some of that also for other program-related costs. So it's a very low-cost program for us to operate administratively. The types of loans we've done, the lowest value loan we've ever done was $150,000, the highest $7.5 million, everything in between. The borrowers, again, are public entities directly. So normally they have an implementation strategy in place. Some will do a conventional design bid build where we're simply the bank and they borrow the money. They spec the project, they bid out different components of it, they have it built, and then like a construction loan, they will invoice us against the line of credit that we've established for them. Then some are design build, which is a more integrated approach, and then we've financed recently probably half the loans are ESPCs, where we provide the financing that an ESCO helps the entity apply for funding through us to finance the project that the ESCO is implementing. The types of things that are eligible that we financed, and it's a very deliberately broad eligibility list. If it is a technology, and this is an equipment financing program, so it's a technology that can reduce energy or water costs, then it probably is going to be eligible. We have some things, specific things that are outlined as eligible, and then kind of a all-encompassing, you know, or anything else that we approve. And so this includes, you know, kind of conventional lighting, HVAC controls, pumps, motors, fixtures, water fixtures, things like that. But then again, because it's not just energy units that we're after, but bottom line costs, things that don't have energy unit savings but have dollar savings, like many of our utilities here will charge a penalty for power factor correction or for power factors. And so power factor correction technologies, things like capacitor banks that can address that penalty, that cost, even though there's not an energy savings, that's something that could be included as well. So that's just kind of a snapshot of the program overall. I'm going to turn it over to Eddie Trevino in our office, who wears at least two hats, most days more than two. One is the Lone Star Program Manager, which he's been in that role for a number of years, and then he's also our SEP manager overall. So, Eddie, do you want to take over and kind of run through some of the other numbers?
Sure, thanks, Ed. If y'all will look on page 10, you'll see categorize the types of loans that we've originated to borrowers. And they fall into basic categories, and starting with state agencies and public higher education, you have local and county governments. There's public school districts, there's junior and community colleges, and there's hospitals. If you look at the numbers, strictly the largest loans are made to state agencies and public higher education. So we've originated 72 loans to that group. And the average payback for those loans is 7 years, 7.1 years. The next largest is local and county governments. And you see we've originated almost $125 million worth of loans, and that's 56 loans. And that average payback is a little bit longer, it's 8.7 years. Then public school districts comes in next, where we've originated $107 million to public school districts. 116 loans, which means they're all – those are the smaller loans we get applications for, and their average payback is just under 8 years. And then finally, you have junior colleges and hospitals, so they're county tax district hospitals, and that's about, for both of them, about $38 million, and that's 24 loans. And you can see the payback, again, is between 8 and 8.5 years overall. So, and it's a combination, like Deb said, of design build, design bid build, and also energy savings performance contracts. Our engineers visit the site four times during the life of the project, and twice during the design phase, and twice, once at 50%, once at 100%, during the retrofit phase. So we actively stay involved in these projects and until their completion and until they're put into repayment. And then once they are in repayment, our finance group follows up with them closely to make sure nobody falls out of sync in terms of payments, because we require quarterly payments for part of the amortization schedule for the loan repayments. So, and that's quarterly payments on our state schedule. So this will give you a good idea of who our audience participation on our program. And you can see it's quite diverse. And it just varies. There's no real pattern over time as when we're going to get a particular applicant or if one dominates over the other. More recently, we've had more higher education loans than school district loans, but that'll probably change over time as well. So if you have any questions after this presentation is over, just let us know. If you have any questions.
Two things I want to point out. One, if you're looking at the slide that has the numbers on it, so you'll see that the total project cost that we've funded, $444 million, is twice what I said earlier, $215 million, the value of our loan fund, which illustrates the fact that, you know, this is a revolving loan fund, and we've actually been able to, you know, finance almost $500 million worth of projects with just over $200 million. So the revolving loan premise works real well for us here. The other thing I didn't mention, which I usually lead with this because we're proud of it, we have had zero defaults through the history of the program. So these 269 loans, zero default rate. And we, you know, lend to really, you know, inherently low-risk pool of borrowers, which are public entities. And then the high level of controls we have on the front end help ensure that the projects perform as expected, providing the headroom and the utility budgets for them to make the repayment. So really those two factors have contributed to that.
And part of our loan audience, a large part of our loan audience, has borrowed more than one time. So they are coming back. They are happy with the program, which is good news for us as well.
So, Sandy, I guess we'll stop there, and I don't know if you want to move on, take questions, or however you want to handle that.
I have a question, Deb.
Yeah.
This is Michelle Pasker. I'm also from Utah.
Yeah.
How do you promote your fund?
Well, a couple of ways. Our audience of borrowers are public entities. We work with different state level associations. Our state association of cities and counties and schools. That way, contractors, ESCOs, are probably our best marketers, because what they do is they have to find money to fund the projects that they're putting together. So they understand how the program works, and they help, you know, bring this option to their customers, to their clients, as a financing alternative. And then the way, at least the last several years, we've run the program is twice a year, we will do a solicitation for new loans. So we'll publish the amount of funding available, the terms, and those go out through the Texas Register, through sort of public networks where, you know, again, public entities are looking for funding opportunities. So several different ways.
And we face the same hurdles like a lot of other people do, in that there's turnover in the school districts and in, within higher education and within agencies. So it's a constant reaching out process and re-education process to the new people who take over the jobs when others move on.
And this is Shauna from Utah as well. I just had a quick follow-up question. Some of the challenges we've had in getting take-up of our fund has been that there's a bit of aversion to taking on a loan, and it's sort of an administrative concern. Has anyone else experienced that problem and been able to sort of come figure out a way to overcome that?
Well, I guess the lesson learned we've had is, yeah, if the CFO, first and foremost, is not on board, then it's going to be tough sledding. The facilities people, the energy managers, they may all understand this and think it's a great idea, but if the CFO, you know, is either debt-averse, loan-averse, whatever, then that can be a stopper. In our program, our controls in the front end very clearly identify what the avoided cost that the project causes will be. And so it should offset if it's executed properly, and we help ensure that that happens. So we tell them, this is a loan, but we're going to point to and show you where your money is for repayment, and it's going to happen within your existing budget. So it's not new debt on top of existing costs. You're creating that headroom, that delta that's going to go back for debt service. And so that usually, you know, it might take a little convincing, but ultimately, you know, I think to CFOs, they see it as a, you know, nets out and allows them to check some of the boxes for deferred maintenance that they couldn't afford otherwise. So they have, you know, viewed this as a positive.
The other thing that happens is for state agencies, our loan is accounted for in their utilities budget.
Operating. And
their operating budget, so that helps reduce resistance. We've run across the same issue with public school districts and local governments because it's accounted for differently. So it all depends how it's accounted for.
Great. Thank you so much. That's really helpful.
Hey, Dub and Eddie, this is Mitchell in Arkansas. Just another quick question. We also operate a revolving loan fund, but we have not had much uptake on ours, usually primarily because it's primarily funded with remaining ARRA dollars. And usually once an entity understands all of the additional requirements that are attached to those, they usually shy away from it. How have you guys gotten around that? I know you have that broad mix of state dollars and ARRA dollars and SEP dollars. So how do you navigate that?
Well, so having multiple types of funding in our program, the ARRA dollars are always least attractive because of those strings.
Yeah.
So what we've done is we've discounted the interest rate we charge on ARRA funds to 1% to offset, you know, essentially the headaches associated with compliance. And we also, with the ARRA funds, what we find is typically we place those tend to be larger projects with larger institutions that have the internal capacity to deal with that. So, you know, we recently, I think, did $5 million.
We've got three, actually, two A&M and one piece of
So recently, like the Texas A&M University System, their flagship campus in College Station, they've dealt with plenty of ARRA money and have systems set up to do that and comply with Davis-Bacon and you name it. So there, they said, sure, we'll take the discounted interest money because we have a system in place to handle ARRA. And so that was a good match. You know, a small rural school district, probably not. That wouldn't be a good fit for them. So we've been able to, you know, sync up ARRA funds with institutions that have the capacity to manage it.
One of the schools that we executed an agreement with out of Houston, what they did is they took the difference in the interest payments from what we were offering with our regular dollars compared to the ARRA, mm-hmm. and they used that to hire a contract FTE to do grant management for that loan specifically.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you.
And that is actually a great question to help us segue into our next speaker, who is Kathy Hornsby with the Alabama Department of Economic and Community Affairs and their Alabama Saves program, which is actually fully ARRA funded. Or Kathy, maybe correct me if I'm wrong. So, and you might have some experiences that talk directly to Mitchell's question. So Kathy, I'll let you share about your program for a few minutes.
Okay, thank you, Cindy. And yes, you are correct. It is funded solely with SEP ARRA funds. That was a great question because I will be the first to admit that those compliance issues have certainly been one of our major headaches. Through trial and error, we have developed processes that help expedite it to some degree. We've educated our participating service providers on Davis-Bacon compliance and those other compliance issues, and that certainly helped. And we've kind of streamlined our process of monitoring that compliance, and now it's working fairly smoothly. I won't say that we don't have bumps in the road, because we certainly do, especially with Davis-Bacon from time to time when we get new contractors who are not familiar with it. But I think that upfront education for them and helping them realize that it can be handled without being such a terrible bear really helps.
Thank you.
Alabama Saves is an example of a third-party administered loan program, and that's what I'm primarily going to focus on today, is that third-party model of administering a loan program. It was established by our office, the ADECA Energy Division, which serves as the State Energy Office for Alabama. And it was actually designed by our current program administrator, Abundant Power. as Sandy mentioned, it was capitalized with SEPR funds. And at the time, we knew we wanted to establish a loan fund, but we really didn't have the in-house staff or expertise to design and manage it. We were pretty swamped at that point in time. As it turns out, the decision to use a third-party administrator has been a good one for us. In fact, the primary catalyst for the success of the program, I would say. Our administrator was selected through a request for proposal and professional services contract process. In the original design phase of the program, written policies and procedures were developed, and a loan review and governance committee was established. The committee is chaired by our office, by ADECA, and composed of ADECA staff and Abundant Power representatives. And it may include others from time to time designated by the committee or ADECA. Both ADECA and Abundant Power work to maintain really close communication, and we've established a clear understanding of the various roles and responsibilities of the two organizations. The administrator's responsibilities include all program processes, including the loan application, credit and energy underwriting, loan closing, loan servicing, data collection and reporting. The administrator reviews all the loan applications and provides feedback to project developers on potential project enhancements that could improve or expand the impact of a project. They provide administrative support to our Loan Review and Governance Committee. They provide energy and credit assessments to members prior to all meetings where loan applications are to be considered. And they provide a written summary of the meetings afterward. They monitor and verify that the applicants and projects selected for loans comply with those ARRA requirements, including Davis-Bacon, National Historic Preservation Act, and NEPA. The administrator is responsible for oversight of the participating service providers, ensuring that our contractors, engineers, and other professionals working on the projects meet established quality assurance and compliance standards, and for developing and maintaining strong working relationships with the private lenders in the state. In addition, the administrator is responsible for marketing the program and maintaining a dedicated program website. Our office, the ADECA Energy Division, oversees their work, chairs and serves on the Loan Review and Governance Committee, co-promotes the program, and of course reports to DOE. There are a few key factors that I would consider essential to our success with the third-party administrator model. One is finding an administrator with the right expertise. Abundant Power provided not only expertise in finance, but also the engineering and legal expertise we needed, including a knowledge and understanding of energy efficiency and renewable energy markets, programs, and technology. Open communication is essential. We maintain frequent email and phone conversations throughout all phases of the project, so if complications develop, which of course they will from time to time, they can be handled in a knowledgeable and an efficient manner. Established written policies and procedures are really important. One of the first things our administrator did was to draft for our approval a program manual, which includes the Loan Review and Governance Charter, underwriting and evaluation guidelines and policies, and a technical guide. These documents guide all our actions with the program, and we try to keep them updated as necessary. It's also important to incorporate a system of checks and balances. Our Loan Review and Governance Committee is structured to provide an appropriate balance of power with final decision-making authority resting with our office. We require dual signatures from the two organizations for loan agreements and loan disbursements. We reconcile escrow accounts monthly, we review monthly and quarterly financial and programmatic reports, and we monitor the administrator as we would any subgrantee or contractor. The final two factors I'd like to mention are helpful, I think, whether you're managing a program in-house or working with a third-party administrator, and that's flexibility and a dedication to continuous improvement. You have to be flexible enough to change directions when needed, and the authority to make those changes needs to be built into the written policies and procedures for the program. Alabama Saves incorporates a robust continuous improvement process. The program is routinely monitored to make sure it's meeting the needs of our target market and achieving our goals and objectives, which can change over time. As a result, Alabama Saves is an evolving program. In fact, we're in the pilot phase of restructuring the program to a participating loan structure now. I'll be glad to provide more information about that at a later date if you're interested. As I said, I've focused primarily on our third-party administrator model here. I haven't given you too many basics about the program because I think some of those have been presented in the past. But if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Well, this is Mitchell in Arkansas again. I'm just curious about this continuous improvement process. Can you just talk about that a little bit more, just so I kind of understand what that looks like, how it happens, and maybe some outcomes of going through that process? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. We're just constantly keeping an eye on if we're really reaching our target market. If we feel like we're slowing or we're having trouble in one area, we'll try to look at it and see what's the problem, what can we do to help facilitate that. The structure of our program has evolved over time. We started out and it was just going to be a straight revolving loan program, and it really got off to a slow start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started, you know, Abundant Power looked at it and came back with some suggestions, and I think we're really innovative at the time that we do kind of a hybrid program where we set aside half of the funds for direct loans and the other half for credit enhancements, loan loss reserves, and interest rate buy-downs.
Right.
That actually proved to be a successful approach, and we really started getting some traction with the program. And then over time, we learned that the loan loss reserves weren't really necessary in most cases to entice the lenders to participate, so we sort of gravitated away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Over the last couple of years, we've been focusing primarily on loans that are subsidized with the interest rate buy-downs. But once again, we start looking at the long-term sustainability over the program, and those interest rate buy-downs are like grants, and we realize that over time that's going to erode the capital base of the program. So once again, we looked at it, how can we work on this, and that's how the administrator came up with this new structure that we are beginning to pilot now, a participating loan program where we'll be working with our private lender partners. We've really developed some good relationships with the private lenders in our state. We've worked with over 38 different banks in the state to date.
Mm.
And they, Abundant Power, talked with them, and it was kind of a, I'm not sure who the suggestion came for first from it, but the lenders were on board to try this participating loan program where we'll be providing like 25% of the capital for direct loans from the lender, and then we'll be able to receive a pro rata share of the interest and the fees that are paid by the borrower. And the lender is their interest in our participation is that our position is subordinate to the bank partner's position. So if there were a default, we'd be in first loss position. But like Texas, we've had a really good track record. We've only had one default to date on loans. So we're also going to be providing a small interest rate subsidy for these loans to help increase demand. But there'll be some, and all of these calculations are being worked out now, so I can't really give details since we're just in the pilot phase, but the interest rate subsidy will have a neutral net present value for the program so that over time it's a wash.
Thank you. What's the overall value of your loan program?
We capitalized the program with $25 million. We've done about $50 million worth of loans to date, and we still have considerable capital left to continue.
Okay.
I think we've got about $10 million, something like that.
Thank you.
And some outstanding principal.
Thank you so much, Kathy. That was a really cool overview of Alabama State. Next up, I asked a couple of other states to talk about their programs, and in my mind, those programs really fall into, you know, direct partnerships with lenders. So I'm going to pass the phone over to Glenn Blackman in Washington, and then following him, Jack Osterman in Nebraska to talk about their respective programs. And Glenn, I believe you have some slides up, so if you all follow along, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yep, that's right, Sandy. Thank you. So the Washington program is part of a larger clean energy fund that the governor proposed when he was running for office in 2012. And an element of this clean energy fund was a financing aspect. And the legislature in 2013 appropriated out of its capital budget $15 million to be used for revolving loan programs. And then last year, in the next capital budget that came up, the legislature liked what it had seen so far and appropriated an additional $10 million for revolving loan programs, as well as a $6 million appropriation for a credit enhancement mechanism that's specific to manufacturing, where the other loan programs are for installation of energy improvements or energy generation equipment. The new element there was at the manufacturing end. On the next slide, you can see that this sort of shows the overall clean energy fund approach, where the program tries to get at a lot of different aspects of the development of a clean energy economy, from the research stage all the way up to the deployment. And you can see that the loans are in the deployment end of this. You know, we are looking to increase the deployment of proven energy technologies by improving the access to capital for businesses and consumers in the state. But it is part of a more comprehensive clean energy program. On the next slide, you can see the design of this. So we often talk about it as a loan program, but we don't actually operate a revolving loan program. Instead, what the state energy office does is provide grants to nonprofit lenders that then they use to fund with some of their own capital revolving loan programs. So we've done two rounds of this now, where we do a competitive process and invite nonprofit lenders. Nonprofit lenders are credit unions and community development financial institutions, other entities that are authorized to make loans in the state but who don't operate on a for-profit basis. We invite them to propose specific markets that they want to serve and specific approaches. It's not a particular approach that we are asking them to, you know, bid on. It's a fairly open-ended solicitation process that we use. We do require, and it's a bit embedded in the appropriation itself, that there's at least a one-to-one leverage of private funds to the state funds, and in almost every case we've seen proposals that come in substantially above that one-to-one leverage. Once we've identified the lenders that we're going to grant funds to, the structure of the grant is such that we give them money in tranches. So that if it turns out they don't perform, that, you know, we've reduced our risk of having money go into a program that's not successful, and it means that we're less likely to have to, you know, try to get that money back from a program that didn't work out. But the lenders themselves are responsible for underwriting the loans and servicing the loans. They identify borrowers who fit their business criteria. The loans are their loans. If there are losses, then it's the lender who absorbs those losses. And they're required to revolve the grant funds for a 10-year contract period. So in some cases, that means that there's no revolvement at all. If there's a 15-year loan, then you know, the money may not be back at all within the 10-year period. But in other cases, the loans are of shorter duration, and for that 10-year period, they need to continue to use those funds for the original purpose. I'm moving to the next slide now. So the first round that we did this, 2 years ago, we had three proposals, which we were a bit disappointed in the number of proposals that we got. We worked with what we had. Of those three, we identified two that we felt that we wanted to fund. Those two were Craft 3, which is a CDFI based here in Washington State. Their sort of target market are distressed communities in the state. They loan to businesses that often would otherwise have little or no access to capital, and so we felt like they fit very well with our notion of trying to expand access to capital. And we granted them $8.7 million for commercial lending, and then $2.9 million for residential lending. And then our second grantee was a credit union, Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union. This credit union's history is as the employee credit union for the state's largest utility, Puget Sound Energy. And they've always had a pretty strong energy focus. They are also very much focused on consumers rather than businesses. And they have worked with other grant funds that we've provided in the past to help move the residential energy efficiency and renewable energy market through low-cost financing. The next slide just shows you a little snippet of the graphics that the two lenders use. These are just screenshots from their web pages. Craft 3 calls their program the Future Energy Fund, and the credit union, their marketing is Energy Smart Loans. Both of these entities, and I would say especially Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union, does not worry a lot about branding for themselves. Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union works with trade allies, contractors and solar installers and people like that, in a very tightly integrated way where, in many cases, the residential borrower may not even be aware of who the lender is until they actually sign the papers. The credit union supplies this financing option that the trade allies then use as part of their sales process to help sell these energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. The next slide shows the results. We're still early in the 10-year window for the grants that we funded in 2014, but you can see that both lenders are off to a great start. Craft 3 has done on the order of $25 million of lending already, and Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union is at about $15 million. And our leverage, is running well above the minimum of 1-to-1 the legislature had established for us. You'll see the credit unions, sometimes people look at that 20-to-1 number and they don't believe me when I say that that's what it is. But the credit union has, not just with this grant, but with several other grants, has established a very strong track record of using a 5% loan loss reserve to support its lending in the residential sector. They put a UCC fixture filing on the property when they do the loan. They have strong underwriting, very streamlined process for approving the loans. So they end up with really very low loss ratios where they feel comfortable with the 5% reserve, and it ends up giving us a leverage rate that we're very happy to take back to the legislature and show them how prudently we are managing these appropriated state funds. We are now, as I mentioned before, in the second round of this, where the legislature did give us a second appropriation. In this round, for the revolving loan funds, we have $9.7 million in grant funds available. Not $9.7, I'm glad to see, but I left a word out there. And we're kind of right in the middle of the solicitation process. We've identified our successful bidders. We were happy to see that we got more proposals than we did last time. And in general, I would say that we got stronger proposals than we did. And we're now negotiating contracts with three of those. Two are the grantees that I've already talked about, Craft 3 and the Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union. Our new grantee, assuming that we get a contract in place with them, is with a state agency. It's the Washington State Housing Finance Commission. Their market is going to be multifamily buildings, you know, apartment buildings, and nonprofit buildings that need energy retrofits, things like, say, YMCA. And then they also are planning to offer loans to help develop community solar projects in our state. We hope to have these contracts completed next month and have them up and running, offering loans with this new new grant, you know, by the time the summer construction season starts. So that's the overview on our program, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have about it. Also, I want to mention that as part of our review process here in round two, one of our review panel members was Sandy Fazelli. She helped us out a lot in terms of sorting through the proposals and helping us identify our best choices, and we thank her for that.
Thanks, Glenn, for including me in it. Since we are nearing the top of our hour, I did want to propose for our final speaker, Jack Osterman in Nebraska, rather than rushing you through your presentation of the Dollar and Energy Savings Loan, that we have you speak at the top of the session next month to continue this discussion on revolving loan funds. Jack, would you be okay with that?
I was hoping you'd come up with that.
Okay.
I think we were running out of time here, and I was a Johnny-come-lately to your invite, so I think it's more appropriate that I go off to another day. So.
Okay.
But I'd be
thank
more
you
than happy to. What?
Thank you for being flexible.
No problem.
Great. Does anyone have any questions for Glenn in the final few seconds of our call? Glenn, I apologize for mismanaging the time. It sounds like maybe there aren't any pressing questions, but I do want to say that the Washington process, having been part of it for this last round, was really interesting. It was exciting to see the nonprofit lenders so engaged and interested in the clean energy financing world, and really helped energize me and helped me come back to NASIO with a newfound appreciation for the work that you all do. So, again, thanks for including me in that. Well, thanks to you all for tuning in this time. For next week or for next month's call, we will have Jack talk to us about Nebraska's program, and I'll also plan to maybe put together a quick draft brief on some of the different issues and questions that were raised over the last hour to see if, you know, having some of those resources down on paper and ideas down on paper is of value for state energy offices working on their RLFs. And with that, I will let you go. And thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. Bye-bye.
Here.
Thank you.